You are listening to WXRW LP Milwaukee 104.1 FM and RiverWestRadio.com globally. CreamCityMedia.com/anti. I'm your host, NTSC, and welcome again to The Anti, a weekly primer on freedom. The Anti is anti-authoritarian, anti-capitalist, anti-hierarchy, anti-sexist, anti-racist, anti-fascist, anti-electoralist, and more. If we're against so much, what do we stand for? The ideals of freedom. In this series, we explore what a free society might look like, while recognizing that none of us today are truly free. As ever, WXRW River West Radio needs your help. Times are tough for nonprofits, and especially so for us nonprofits who seek to engage, educate, and activate the at-risk and the disenfranchised. If you want to help us out, donate today online. You can join our Patreon campaign, or you can come on into the station at 824 East Center Street, Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and purchase some gear. And then wear that gear or use that gear. Or if you represent an entity of some kind locally, reach out and become an official underwriter. You can support us, and in so doing, we will make sure that everybody knows about you and the good work that you're doing. The year at time of broadcast is 2019, and things look pretty grim. Globally, the top 1% richest elite own fully half of all the wealth in the world, while the remaining 99% of the world's population scrabble over the remainder. A list of around 2,000 billionaires literally control the governments of the entire world through both clandestine and blatant manipulation. And they do so violently. The permafrost is melting at a dizzying pace along with the ice caps and glaciers. According to research by the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, somewhere between the years 2038 and 2045, the global human population will experience the complete collapse of our habitable environment as we have known it for the whole of our evolution. The seas will rise and swallow our coasts and small islands. Storms of unbelievable intensity will ravage the mainland. We are even destabilizing the very ground we walk on. Thousands of species of animals are dying off, and we are crowding them all further and further into the corners of existence. According to polls, you probably already know all of this. And it's not that you don't care. Polls show that the grand majority of us care very deeply. Data shows with no doubt that the majority of us are scared and angry and want to do something to change things for the better. But we also feel powerless in the face of it all, due in large part to the fact that our ability to enact real change is being violently oppressed. The state defends the status quo, and it does so with a complete monopoly on violence. There can be no people's insurrection that will not be violently attacked by the state's police and military arm. Those in power want us to engage with them in what they would call civil terms. They want us to be civilized, even while they willfully demolish any and all future your children might have had. And it's not grandchildren anymore. It's your children, nieces, nephews who will have no future. And yet they want civility, and they can demand it because all violent means belong to them. We are not allowed to defend ourselves. To do so would be illegal. Whereas the rape of the natural world is quite legal and highly profitable. Okay, so I've thoroughly depressed myself. So what on earth is today's show about? Well, it's been roughly 32 episodes since we set aside talking about the ills of our current system and society and talked instead about our awesome shared potential and what our future can look like if we try and make it that way together. Today's show will focus on turning away from the dystopian futures described in cyberpunk epics like Blade Runner, Neuromancer, and Akira, and instead we will turn towards a newer, sunnier science fiction trend that has been developing for the last few years called solarpunk. Today's show will imagine a way to get there. I'm going to display eager and excessive optimism in this week's show, but not on an unrealistic level. I've met enough people in my life across America and also abroad to know that we have more in common than we have differences among us. So I'm going to recite the world's future as if from the perspective of a historian, describing how the human race pulled itself out of the ravages and atrocities of the oil age into the sunshine of the solar era. Hey, everybody. All right. Let's please settle in and we will begin. I hope you had a chance to finish the chapter on the collapse of the early 2000s. We're ready to move on to a really exciting period in human history, the Great Transition, as it was colloquially termed in the mid-2050s. Okay, so in the year 2019, things looked pretty grim for all the reasons that we discussed last session. Many superpowers across the globe had elected rampant profiteers to positions of great influence, and popular power was at an all-time low, even lower than it was in the Bronze Age, the Iron Age, and the Dark Ages. So starting in late 2019 and into 2020, popular power began to manifest in groups of grassroots, non-hierarchical organizing. Many factions existed with various differences among them, but the common thread that linked them was a firm stance on regeneration and sustainability, and a passionate desire for equality, which, if you'll remember, was in very short supply. And you have to remember that the oil age was a time of incredible violence, and the people understood this. They knew that historically, revolutions based entirely on violent self-defense were often squashed by the powers that be. And even those that survived were inevitably co-opted by the most violent actors from within their ranks, who only created new systems of inequality and violent control. In the wake of the disastrous elections of 2020, 2022, and 2024, the people adopted new models, which emphasized small collectives supporting each other while ceasing participation in the dominant economic model entirely. And it was the adoption of this new tactic, non-participation, that created the necessary sea change. One neighborhood in particular, located in Abitibiwit Zagaigun, began a coordinated and revolutionary practice of non-participation, first by gathering together the physical currency that was prevalent at the time and burning it in a large local space, which was called at the time a parking lot. And that was a huge lifeless expanse of concrete meant only for temporary storage of oil-based individual transport. The act was not only defiant in the face of the establishment hierarchy, but also quite dangerous at the time, since the burning of physical currency was grounds for violent action on the part of the hierarchy against the people. At first, the hierarchy didn't pay much attention, you know, expecting that the insurrection of non-participation would fizzle out when faced with material scarcity. But that didn't happen. The group organized with two simple goals, arrived at by consensus decision-making. The two agenda items were subsistence and what they called thriving, which we would recognize today as just very, very basic self-actualization. But it was considered extremely revolutionary at the time, in the late 2020s. Small community defense groups were organized across the smaller city-states, which were kind of less influenced by the majority hierarchy, especially where there was still access to less toxic soil and less polluted water. Those groups joined their collective assets together into a shared, democratically utilized material trust, which was managed with the communal goal of providing life essentials, somatic well-being, freedom of spirit, and vitality of the mind. Some few of the original self-managed groups infiltrated the structures of hierarchy, called stores at the time, and made widely available to other groups the material items found therein, which represented foodstuffs, the means to grow more foodstuffs, as well as clothing, tools, medicine, literature, bedding, and such and such. And again, remember that freely distributing those items without rendering currency to the hierarchies that claimed dominion at the time was further grounds for violent retribution on behalf of those self-same hierarchies. We don't have a word for it now, but if you recall our chapter on slavery, these early non-participants were risking enslavement, injury, and death by liberating those material goods to their fellows. And indeed, some of them were caught and caged, and others were killed outright. And for context, I recommend rereading or refamiliarizing yourself with the chapters on pigment-motivated, gender-motivated, and sex-oriented hierarchical violence. Despite campaigns of hierarchical violence against some of the original revolutionary non-participators, the general thrust of the tactic began to get adopted more broadly as word spread. More and more people began to work together in small organizing groups of neighborhoods, providing for each other without engaging with the dominant hierarchy at all. They refused to transact or interact in any way that was inequitable or bore a negative impact on the shared habitat. As word spread of these small groups organizing to meet each other's needs through mutual aid and consensus democracy, more and more people began to organize their own. Non-participation also meant that these early adopters all did something which at the time was considered irrational in the extreme. Recall the earlier chapters on labor slavery. Well, in vast droves, people began to abandon their labor slavery engagements. And this was called colloquially quitting your job, which sounds really strange to us. But you have to remember that in the context of what a job was back in the 2030s, for the most part, they were activities which added no measurable value to anyone's life. And in fact, they often harmed the people participating mentally, spiritually, physically, and emotionally. If you or I, today were forced to engage in any of those activities, we would find it funny at first to see just how pointless and circular most of them were. But it would get less and less funny as you came to realize you were forced through threat of violence to engage. More and more hierarchical currency entities were forced to abandon their pursuits as the people who used to work there abandoned their labor slavery positions to join the non-participatory working groups. Some of the early communities to adopt the tactic of non-participation were less advantaged in the way of resources, which could be shared in common. So they had less of an opportunity to directly support one another as the campaign started to gain momentum. Theirs was a much more difficult struggle. Following a strong ethic of total non-participation, these radicals all quit their jobs, abandoning their posts at labor slavery ventures. And if you want to reference the glossary again, these positions were referred to by a lot of different names, depending on what kind of labor they were, for the dominant profiteers, depending sometimes on where they were. Some of the vocabulary from last week, if you remember, was clerk, retail salesperson, receptionist, manager, server, or waitstaff, again, depending on what geographic location they were in, administrative assistant, data entry clerk, records clerk, marketing coordinator, project lead, IT business analyst, brand ambassador, consultant, copywriter, media buyer, relations liaison, and more. In the cities where material scarcity was a concern, these brave non-participants simply stopped attending their labor slavery engagements and also stopped using the profiteer currency, which was dominant at the time. And yes, I can see exactly what your next question is going to be. How did they survive if they weren't selling their labor anymore? And they also weren't spending currency to meet their material needs. And they also weren't able to seize the means to survive like the other non-participants we were discussing. Well, essentially, they organized what would have been referred to as a mass strike. You'll recall that term from earlier chapters on labor theory. So they gathered en masse in city and town squares and just sat. They talked, they sang, and they made known that they were not going to engage anymore. Theirs could also be described as a hunger strike, because they couldn't eat, and very rarely could they drink. There were some freely available fountains for drinking at, but even those eventually would become unavailable. So they just sat, unwilling to sell their bodies for wages anymore, and equally unwilling to engage in further labor slavery. They made a very visible point by merely existing out in the open, right in front of the profiteers who had controlled their lives before. They made the bold and visible claim that their lives were worth more than any currency could purchase, and that they would no longer feed the devious machine of capital which had so corrupted the world. The guards of the profiteers caged some of them, but the vast scale and size of the strike overwhelmed the established authorities. All they were doing was starving in public. And with nobody to work in their stores and factories and markets, all of the profiteers' enterprises had become useless. And eventually, when strikers started dying there in the streets, the guards would eventually open up the resources for them in grand defiance of the profiteers against whom they all eventually turned. And in the year 2032, the dominant hierarchy began to really panic. If you remember the term economy from last year's sessions, well, the economy had collapsed entirely. The imaginary currency, which had made life so good for an infinitesimally small minority of profiteers, was becoming more and more meaningless as fewer and fewer normal people used it at all. So many communities had organized mass burnings of the currency, and the hierarchies were beginning to really worry. Beyond that, the total majority of people no longer capitulated to labor slavery, forcing any hierarchical entity that hadn't fully automated to shut down. The dominant hierarchy first tried to tempt the people to return to their positions of labor slavery by offering currency incentives. But by this time, the people had gotten a taste of consensus democracy and had really gotten to know their neighbors as they shared work and play and really an interconnectedness of their livelihoods. So nobody was tempted by those early attempts. As neighbors began to reorganize and relocate their infrastructure, fewer and fewer individual transports were needed. So their parts, their mechanical parts and their electronic and digital parts and computers were repurposed to automate tasks of drudgery in these communities. And it should be noted that at first, the dominant hierarchy attacked non-participatory groups that restructured their local infrastructure. To use the terminology of the era, groups seized institutional buildings, abandoned commerce structures and the like, and repurposed them as gardens, nurseries, dormitories, schools, apartments, and whatever else a neighborhood needed to subsist and thrive. The hierarchy eventually sicked its guards on the earliest groups, but as currency lost all value and labor slavery began to ebb in favor of free shared work, even those employed by the dominant hierarchy to enact its violence began to kind of come to their senses and join the groups in non-participation. They realized they had more in common with the people they were supposed to be attacking than the people telling them to do the attacking. The dominant profiteers eventually lost all support. By the early 2040s, the jig was up, so to speak. Most of the small to mid-sized cities had been completely reorganized by small neighborhood groups into functional communities based on sane, equitable distribution of labor and materials. Consensus democracy was the tool of every community, and as people's needs were met and exceeded, violence all but disappeared. Where conflict did occur, transformative justice was utilized to heal the community and discover the root cause to better address and create processes for the future. Without any help from the dominant hierarchy, the people had dramatically decreased their negative influence on the habitat by reorganizing their communities. They did away with the need for individually operated oil-based transport, instead providing safe routes for walking, biking, and motoring for those with disabilities. They halted heavy commerce industry entirely simply by quitting it, cutting its impact on the air and water to zero. They utilized simple techniques for repurposing the literal billions of tons of textiles, papers, plastics, and similar materials that they got from the abandoned commerce factories and distributaries. As technologies advanced, finally liberated from the insane metric of profit, which you'll remember from earlier chapters, material goods used and shared among the community were designed to last forever and be upgradable in perpetuity as new advances and uses were discovered. Aquaponics and wetlands were conceived and built on a vast scale to sequester carbon, filter toxins from the atmosphere and water supply, and provide safety for animal life. Buildings that were once used only to imprison labor slaves in the pursuit of currency for the dominant elite were repurposed as vertical gardens, which grew a vast surplus of crops for all communities. What started out as a project of small groups in neighborhoods numbering only a few hundred households eventually expanded and interconnected to whole cities. As the need for heavy transport of currency-based, profit-motivated materials became unnecessary, the majority of transportation infrastructure was demolished, and the materials thereof repurposed to better serve the community. The remaining transportation infrastructure was shored up and solidified with sustainable and easily repaired materials that were not designed to require replacement every season. The removal of the vast majority of dangerous, ugly roads, freeways, highways, and the like, freed up more space for natural wildlife to again take hold. Forests were seeded and encouraged to grow. Grasslands and wetlands were revitalized. The natural world began to heal and regenerate, while human society either kept its distance or designed non-invasive structures that blended in with the surrounding environment. When the infrastructure that ripped liquid and solid fossil fuels from the earth were abandoned by the workers and there was nobody left who was willing to toil for the profiteers, those energy sources too were abandoned over the course of only a few years. Once the foundations of all energy demands, oil, petroleum, gasoline, coal, and tar sands were all left unattended, non-functioning, and finally non-destructive to the habitat. Even the giant nuclear power plants were abandoned by the workers, along with the terrifying threat that they posed to all organized life. It would take some time, but eventually all of the old energy structures themselves would be dismantled and their parts and pieces used to gather wind, solar, geothermal, tidal, and wave energy, which yielded vastly more in terms of quality and in quantities that are effectively limitless. One of the old status quo industries that was quickest to die came as a bit of a shock to the early non-participators. Huge firms that owned and operated what we would call communication today were marshaled solely towards vast rewards for the dominant profiteers. With telecommunications and media workers abandoning their posts in droves, there was nobody to disseminate the falsities that permeated the social discourse. The necessity of the day was for people to interact with each other, face to face, in person, so as to achieve their common goals. Any attempt on the part of the profiteers to corrupt the minds of the masses became quickly irrelevant. When the dominant hierarchy was no longer capable of successfully lying to the masses on a grand scale, the misinformation they sowed fell on deaf ears, scattered to the winds without so much as a hiccup in reply. The cruelties of industrial farming were abandoned entirely, as it was only ever perpetuated by the greedy profiteers who benefited from the sadistic practice. Those communities that still desired participation in animal husbandry did so through ethical, sustainable practices and never on a scale beyond what was actually necessary. The adoption of a more natural, unprocessed diet eliminated many of the chronic illnesses that plagued the people of the oil age. Eventually, the waters and soil were depleted of the myriad toxins, microplastics, and heavy metals that the oil age had littered them with, and the habitat became livable again. Quality of life, length of life, and personal freedom all soared as we entered the dawning of the solar age, around 120 years ago. You may be asking what happened to the profiteers, the dominant hierarchies and selfish, greedy sociopaths who wished to kill the world. In early days of non-participation, there were lots and lots of angry people who wanted to visit harm upon those monsters. They talked about punishing them, caging them, or outright killing them. By the time the structures of control and manipulation had finally collapsed under their own weight, without the workers to hold them aloft, those profiteering elite had no choice but to try and join society. Their guards had left them long ago. Their obscene hordes of imaginary currency were useless, nothing more than long lines of digits in a forgotten database somewhere. They had no more than anyone else did, except that they had much less social goodwill, for everyone knew it was they who had nearly killed the world. The people knew they were monsters, but by the time those profiteers needed to join society, the people were so engaged in the good work of creating themselves and a better world, they paid them no mind. They had learned by that point that they had no right to forgive those people any more than they had a right to vilify them. And so they all just got on with the work of helping each other fix the world. It all began by our ancestors being brave enough to stop participating in the structure of violent control from unfair, inequitable hierarchies. It took a great deal of bravery on their part to risk the dangers of privation and hierarchical violence. But by removing their labor, by removing their economic input into the system of structural violence, they forced the gears of cruelty and slavery to grind to a halt. All they needed to do was recognize the incredible power they had and decide to work together to support and defend each other. It just took them realizing that they were in it together and to take those first steps towards creating a better world. And so ends our theoretical history class. Everything I described is possible. If we were willing to be brave and support one another, we could put an end to this system which enslaves us all and literally kills our shared heritage and future. It would be scary, and it would not be without risks. But if we all decided that enough was enough, we could work towards realizing a future beyond the oil age. Thank you for tuning into The Anti here on WXRW River West Radio. I've been your host, NTSC, and I'll be back again next week to discuss further topics as they relate to freedom and our awesome shared potential. Past episodes can be found at creamcitymedia.com/anti, and more information about the show can be found on riverwestradio.com.